Shrink Wrap Radio number 470, The Cycle of Life, with Israeli Jungian analyst Dr. Erel Shalit.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my guest is Israeli Jungian analyst Dr. Erel Shalit, and we'll be discussing his book, The Cycle of Life, Themes and Tales of the Journey. For more information about Dr. Erel Shalit, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Dr. Erel Shalit, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
David, thank you so much, and thank you for inviting me. And thank you for, in any case, for the great work that you're doing. I have listened to some of the interviews, and I've heard about your interviews. So thank you so much for that community service that you're doing.
Well, that is so gratifying to hear. And it's great to have this opportunity to speak with you. And I've become increasingly aware of your work. I first became acquainted with your work as a result of my interview with Dr. Nancy Ferlotti on the book Dream Amplification, which the two of you edited. And then in my more recent interview with her on Eric Neumann.
Right.
And there was a major conference in Israel not long ago about Eric Neumann. Were you the organizer or one of the principals in that conference?
I was the organizer, and I was chair of the conference. And in fact, it began in a very interesting way. That doesn't have anything to do with the book about the cycle of life. It may have something to do with my cycle of life, personally.
Yeah, well, tell us about it.
Well, after so many years, the correspondence between Jung and Eric Neumann was published this year, 2015, while we know that both of them died in 1960 and 1961, respectively. So it has taken a very long time to manage to get all parties together to publish this correspondence. And when we managed to sign the agreement back in 2012 with the Jung Foundation, the Philemon Foundation that prepared the correspondence for correspondence, and I as the representative of the Neumann heirs, it was in fact Ulrich Herny, Jung's grandson, who suggested that we launch the book and arrange this conference in Israel. And that's why I took it upon myself to go ahead with this pretty big venture.
Yeah, I'm sure it was a big responsibility. I've never run a conference. I haven't managed to dodge that bullet so far.
Well, I have now done this conference, and I'm not going to do any further conference. It was obviously greatly successful. And great attendance from more than 25 countries, attendees from more than 25 countries. But it took a full year, practically full time, to maneuver and get all that working.
Sure, I can imagine. And you've been very busy with lots of activities. And on YouTube, I discovered that you've lectured here in California at the Pacifica Graduate Institute.
Right. I've done that a few times, and I will be there. I will be there in November of this year.
Well, very good. Although I'm in the same state, it's a long ways away from where I am. California is a very long state.
Yeah, I know. I come from a very small one.
Right. Okay, so today, as you alluded, we're going to be discussing your book, The Cycle of Life. And basically, your book is about the stages of life that we all pass through. And of course, there were Freud's ideas about the developmental stages focusing on childhood, and then later those of Erik Erikson, which included adulthood. Your focus in the book is on a Jungian perspective and emphasizes archetypal elements explored through metaphor, myth, and dreams. Is that a fair description?
Definitely. Thank you.
Okay.
It's a very nicely stated.
Okay. Well, before we get into your book, maybe you can tell us about what set you on the path of this ambitious project, because you're trying to cover an awful lot, right?
Well, so far you've mentioned Freud, Jung, and Erikson, and all three of them were, in fact, instrumental in setting me on this path. Freud, obviously, because he did categorize the stages of childhood, seeing them as a universal phenomena. We are supposed to pass through these stages of childhood without being fixated, and if we resolve one, we move relatively smoothly on to the next, but right. We have to stand up to the different challenges. Mm-hmm. Erikson, well, he set me off because, first of all, I've always been attracted to his writings. And I noticed so many times when lecturing on this subject that people recall that he wrote about the stages of life, but that is not actually the title of his essay. It's The Ages of Life. Mm-hmm. And that made me try to bridge Erikson and Jung, which may not be so easy, because I think that Erikson had a hinge, understood that it's not just the development through stages, but that each stage in life is also, in an archetypal sense, a distinct age. It has its own qualities, it has its own distinct challenges, and those ages may remain, or should preferably remain, in the person as we go through all the different stages.
So it's not like we leave it and it's gone forever, but somehow those issues are still alive within us.
Exactly. On an archetypal level, those issues preferably should be alive, even though they should not be dominant mm-hmm. at a different age or stage.
Right.
And let me just mention why Jung set me off on this, because in his very early essay on the stages of life, and he calls it the stages of life, from the early 1930s, I was curious that he devotes so much in that essay to speak about problem. Because without problems, mm-hmm. we don't experience and we don't reflect upon the life that we are going through. It's as if we don't have a sense of the problems, it is as if we are passively moved through life rather than actively relating to life, with turning it into the conscious life. And that is what I think is Jung's tremendous contribution here.
Spoken like a true Jungian. The idea that it's necessary to bring awareness and consciousness rather than just kind of moving through and passively. I'll have to think about that, because I think I've not always felt like I was the actor in the sense of having a plan. for my life. Mm-hmm. I've kind of gone through doors as they've opened up. And so that's more my sense rather than a really very conscious movement. So, but I'm not supposed to be on the couch here.
Well,
I invited a lot, though.
Yeah, we can certainly discuss that. But I don't think that we can always consciously determine in advance what doors we're going to go through. I do think it's we do have a certain obligation to consider, to contemplate, to reflect when we find ourselves at the crossroads.
Yes, the crossroads. So that's one of the archetypes that you discuss that always resonates very strongly with me, blues music, and the meeting the devil at the crossroads. So that's a strong association I have. And I interviewed, I'm going to block on his name now, a Jungian analyst who's written about the folk music called the blues, and
Mark
Winburn, yes. Yeah.
Who is a lovely person, and I consider him a friend of mine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, good. Well, I really enjoyed discovering that he had written on that. That was because I've long loved the blues. So if you don't mind, I'd like to kind of step you through the broad outline of the book. And in the book, you share so many wonderful myths and stories. So I hope you'll feel free to sprinkle in any of those here that make sense, or they don't even have to have been in the book if there's, you know, something that comes mm-hmm. to mind. So, well, of course, the first metaphor is that of the journey. And right. That's an archetypal idea in itself, right?
Right.
So what can you tell us about the journey as a guiding metaphor for looking at the lifespan?
Well, I think that pertains to the metastructure or the metapsychology of the individuation process. We can at least imagine ourselves as crossing our lifespan on a journey. I use the river as an image for that.
Yes.
The river that has its origin in a source and eventually runs out into the ocean, where our individual journey joins up with the collective, with collective humanity, with the world soul, the anima mundi. And traveling and the river has, of course, two distinct features. One is the relative stability of riverbeds. There is something that is quite determined. The riverbeds change very slowly. The course of the river changes very, very slowly over time. But on the other hand, the river changes during the seasons. There are rivers that have a wonderful, bubbling, lifeful, energetic stream, and there are rivers that are nearly dried up, which here in my area of the world, the Wadi, the dried up river, is very significant.
You know, I should mention in that respect that you're in Israel, I'm in California. I forgot to mention that to listeners, so go ahead.
So you are experiencing the morning while I experience the light evening breeze as dark has already set in in Tel Aviv.
Yeah, very much so. And, of course, getting back to what you were saying, we're going through a drought right now, and so that's very much impacting the whole river metaphor and water.
Right,
in a very real way.
Yeah.
And so I'm interested in the way that you just outlined the river as having these two aspects, one that is very stable and steady, but mm-hmm. then there's all this variation on the surface, and it actually in some ways foreshadows something that I think we'll talk about towards the end of the book, which is the idea of what in some ways our life is set. There's some degree of predestination, if you will.
Right.
But at the same time, things happen. We make decisions, and there's the whole issue of free will.
I think you touch upon what I see as perhaps the central theme in my book, which is the axis, the span, the tension, the conjunction between predetermined fate, what has been spoken by the gods.
Yes.
What is predetermined, if we translate the gods into archetypes, what seems to be determined archetypally, which includes, for instance, where I was born and the time I was born, and the span between predetermined fate and individual destiny. What is my destiny? What is my goal? Towards what am I heading? The aspect of individual decision making, free will, and versus the predetermined. And I think that there is a constant tension, constant negotiation.
Yeah. You know, this topic feels so juicy that I'm going to skip to the end of the book instead of going straight through as I planned, because you have this chapter called, or section called, Homage to Sophocles. And in it, you relate this play. I think most of us are familiar with Oedipus Rex and the story of Oedipus, who I guess is for a seer of some sort. An oracle, right? It kind of lets him know his destiny way in advance, that he's going to end up killing his father, maybe even the sleeping with his mother. This, of course, happens as he goes along. He goes through great anguish and gouges out his eyes. So Sophocles and you pick up the story towards the end of his life, which I had never heard before about the Sophocles play. And one part that, and you can take us through that, but the one part that really caught my interest was Oedipus kind of excusing himself, saying, well, look, yes, I did kill my father and I slept with my mother, but, you know, that's the god. That's blame it on the gods. That was predestined. I really didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
And there is that tension, and I'm aware of that too, because the interview that I did before this was with a psychologist who listens to murderers. He's written a marvelous book, and there's that tension in the law that you can understand the murderer's story, and when you hear what the murderer, the environment that he came through, and all the things that he was subjected to as a child and the abuse and so on, the fact that he later becomes a murderer almost seems inevitable, and yet the law always has to deal with that tension that you were just talking about.
Yeah.
Sorry to hear you had such a difficult life, but we're going to punish you.
Right. Well, the law is often confronted with dilemmas that are so not simple, even though sometimes law, as the executor of collective consciousness, simplifies things. Just to give you one example, when Adolf Eichmann was tried in Israel, the prosecutor said that the court is confronted with the enormous problem of how to prosecute a mass murderer who has not killed a single person. That is one dilemma. You're mentioning Oedipus towards the end of his life, and I personally think that Oedipus at Colonus is one of the greatest plays from ancient Greece. It's usually not read. It's so rare that I recall once when I went into, I was giving a lecture on this subject in Stockholm, Sweden, and I was looking for a copy of Oedipus at Colonus in Swedish. And I entered a bookstore of secondhand books, and I, of course, found there Oedipus Rex, King Oedipus. And I went up to this elderly, very lovely lady who obviously owned a bookstore. And I asked her, I showed her the copy of King Oedipus. And I asked her, do you happen to have Oedipus at Colonus? And she took up the book, held it in her hands, looked a few times on the front cover and the back cover, and she said, well, we don't, but if this is a popular author, I'm sure we're going to have some new material by him soon. So Oedipus at Colonus is unfortunately not a very well-read book. Let me, in fact, I just found the page here where I quote the piece, that section that you...
Yes, I marked that section in my book, too. Yeah. Go ahead.
And Oedipus, of course, pleads not guilty for having carried out what amounts to his foredoomed fate. And he says in this incredible section, he says, the gods so willed it. Doubtless an ancient grudge against our house. My life was innocent. Search as you will of any guilty secret for which this error could have been the punishment, this sin that damned myself and all my blood. Oh, tell me, he says, if my father was foredoomed by the voice of heaven to die by his own son's hand, how can you justly cast it against me, who was still unborn when that decree was spoken?
It's interesting that you went right to that, because I was, you know, I do a commentary after the interview usually, and I had in my mind, I tagged that I was going to read that passage.
Yeah, I think it's a very powerful passage. And the chorus, in fact, does agree with Oedipus. He manages to convince them. I personally remain somewhat unconvinced. Yeah, we are predetermined in so many ways. I personally, for instance, as a Jew, am acutely aware of the time of being born, because I know that if I was born in just a few years earlier than I was born, and in a somewhat different location, then I would probably have been murdered as a child, or not born, because my parents would have been murdered. So I acutely feel the impact of the archetypal fate, the historical fate, the godly spoken fate, or whatever we call it. But still, I cannot put really anything beyond my own responsibility. I need to carry my responsibility. I need to respond to the fate that in certain ways have been given to me. Mm-hmm. I need to respond, take that responsibility, and feel the guilt that comes along with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another theme that we'll come back to. Maybe towards the end. Let me jump back towards the beginning of the journey again. And of course, the journey, it's such a natural and archetypal idea. I'm thinking of, in literature, we have Don Juan, the first picaresque novel, which is about his travel along the road, you know, all the way to modern times with Jack Kerouac on the road.
On the road.
Yeah. And then in between, just so many stories, novels, and so on, about being on the road, a journey. One that sticks out in my memory, too, is Journey to the East. Mm-hmm. Don't block on his name. Help me. Who wrote Journey to the East? You must know it.
Yes, of course I know it.
And I know it, too. I'll say it again. I'll say it towards later. It'll pop into my mind.
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, boy, that drives me nuts. It happens all the time. So at any rate, now when you're talking about one of the phrases, actually, I think it was a section heading that you used, which I found particularly evocative, was your discussion of being on the way, that of being on the journey, being on the way versus a way of being.
Right.
Yeah, unpack that for us a bit.
Well, it's a quote from Carl Kearney. Being on the way as a way of being is the polar opposite to being in one place, being at home. And we live in a restless world. We live in a world where location is disintegrating. I think that's why many of us are concerned with ecology, which comes from echo, meaning home, the Greek word for home, where we want this place on earth to remain a viable home. That's one part, but we also need to be the traveler. If we need to travel in our own life, it's not necessarily in geography, but in psychography. And we need those two aspects. The neurotic person is the reluctant traveler. He or she will say, not now, will avoid the traveling, will avoid crossing the ocean or traveling down the river. The neurotic person will say, it's too late, or the time is not ripe yet. Now is never right. So the neurotic person is a reluctant traveler. The psychotic person is the erratic traveler, without a compass, without a connection to a gyroscope.
Okay.
The gyroscope, which keeps a ship balanced in relation to Earth. In a certain way, I see the Jungian self as a gyroscope. It keeps us connected with those greater forces in life, in the world, in our human community, on Earth. It holds the balance between the captain of the ship, the ego, the captain of the ship, and the greater self. So we can travel in different ways, and that, I think, is the individual in relation to that predestined or predetermined, those many aspects that are predetermined by genetics, by history, by geography, etc., and by culture.
Yeah. So again, being on the way, the journey versus a way of being, and the way I'm hearing a way of being relates back to what you were talking about, being conscious, that being as a way of life, as a philosophy of life, if you will, to be conscious of the journey. And by the way, the name that I was blocking on was Hermann Hesse.
Yeah.
it did come back to me. And I recently reread it and discovered that it wasn't all like I remembered it. So somehow I had changed it into whatever I needed it to be. And for me, it was a story about some people who were on the journey, and then they got separated and lost, and they forgot. They forgot what the journey was about. They forgot where they were going. And then later, they kind of meet up again, and it's kind of like, oh, some recognition. Mm-hmm. That's how I – there was a lot of other stuff in there that as I read it again, I was like, oh, I'm not interested in that part. In this part of the book, you also have an interesting discussion of the god Hermes. What's his relevance in this context that we're talking about right now?
Well, you know, isn't it fascinating that Hermes, who is the god of travelers, besides being the god of businessmen and thieves and other...
It's a strange mix.
It's an interesting mix, definitely. That he is also... he's, of course, the god who of souls. He's the only one who has a permanent visa to enter into the netherworld and get out of there. So he, in fact, travels not only horizontally, he travels vertically as well, downwards and upwards. He can fly on winged sandals, and he can go down into the depths. He can also, as an image, of course, and not a personification, he's a personified image of something. Is it an image also of hermeneutics, of the hidden script, of what's there in between the lines? And he is also connected to what is hermetically sealed. And it's in the hermetically sealed vessel that we imagine that therapeutic and analytic transformation takes place. So that seems, at least on the surface, to be contradictory to the god of Rhodes. But it is in the hermetically sealed vessel that we go through our internal transformations, that we travel internally. If we are constantly exposed to the external noise, and in today's world we have such a difficulty of concentrating, we have such a difficulty withdrawing into our own state of reflection and contemplation. We hardly are able to read a book all through any longer, because we need to check emails, and some of us might feel a need to check the Twitter account, and of course on Facebook there are constantly a constant stream of news. We are all, I think, becoming having attention deficit disorder.
Mm-hmm. I will confess, I certainly struggle with that, and agree with you about that. And as you're talking about the hermetic containers, making me think of alchemy, and all those images of, and that idea that we sort of need to cook with our issues. And I think that Hermes is actually depicted in some of that alchemical drawings from the Middle Ages.
Yeah, I am not that familiar with the alchemy. I, as a Jungian, I've done my basic learning of it. But sure, Hermes and Hermes Trismegistus is, of course, an important figure. But Hermes, the Greek god, is, I think, tremendously significant in the conceptualization and idea of our soul traveling.
Mm-hmm. So just to recap a bit then, each of the archetypal stages will confront us with one or more challenges, which if successfully dealt with will further our growth, or if not successfully dealt with will hold us back or even become pathological obstacles. Does that sound right?
Yeah. Let me try to say a few words about that.
Good.
I do believe that each age of the human being, or each stage, if we look at it from a developmental perspective, presents us with challenges. Erik Erikson defined For instance, the initial stage of basic trust versus mistrust, and the in late life, ego integrity versus despair. So I do think that there, and of course Freud did that as well. From an archetypal perspective, I think that there are issues that pertain, that we can elaborate on, that reflect some of those issues. So if we take the child, for instance, the idea, the child from an archetypal perspective is the idea of child, not only one's personal childhood. It's the idea of child. The idea of child pertains, for instance, to the living in the more mystical, in something that is closer to nature, to the unconscious. And there we can crystallize, out of that, we can crystallize certain images. We can crystallize the divine child, which shows the vicinity to the archetypal sphere, to the archetypal dimension. The divine child carries the name of divinity. We see that, we sense that often in the infant. We look at the infant, and if we have the child constellated in us, we will see the beauty, the divinity, the transpersonal, the grandeur of this little child, who doesn't have to accomplish anything. It's pre-ego. We don't ask, hopefully, of a 6 weeks old child to do anything. And when the child smiles at us, we are affected. Our hearts beat, and we feel elevated by the interaction with divinity. And so, of course, Jung used the image of the divine child, and others have as well, as an image for the self. But now, that is not the only image that I believe it is important to experience as a child, to be related to as carrying that divinity. There is also the orphan child, the orphan who is so tremendously popular. There are so many fairy tales about the orphan child. Not to speak about Charles Dickens, who very touchingly wrote about the orphan child, the child who is in fact abandoned, the child who finds him or herself alone. We have The Little Match Girl by Anderson. Anderson was, of course, also in touch with the image that we might call the orphan child. Mm-hmm. And I believe that the orphan child pertains to that sense of abandonment, which is inevitable in any kind of development. Because if we take an initial stage of divinity, or a sense of divinity, a sense of the paradisical, of paradise, which of course doesn't, in no child, however fantastic his or her parents are not providing paradise. But that's something of what we try to do that often.
Right.
with newborn children. But at some stage, that has to be abandoned. However good it has been, at some stage it needs to be abandoned. Because otherwise there's no development. Otherwise it becomes something decadent.
Yeah.
And abandonment inevitably makes us attach to the idea, the psychic image of the orphan. And that, if I may add a word here on the difference, the similarity and the difference between trauma and complex.
Okay.
If that's okay.
Sure.
Complexes in Jungian terminology are primarily teleological. They are purposeful. They are not only complexes that we suffer from. That may happen, and I'm not going to go into how that happens, but that means that the orphan child as a complex is tremendously important, and we are all in touch with it because most of us love to hear or loved to hear those stories about those poor children of Anderson and Dickens and others, because it speaks, it resonates with the orphan child within us. That does not mean that that we experienced in real life orphanage. That may happen as a trauma. If, tragically, a child is exposed to the actualization in his or her real life of the orphan because of a loss of a parent or an absent parent or a depressed parent or a parent who in some other way is malfunctioning vis-a-vis that particular child, then what happens, as I see it, is that the transformative complex, which at a certain moment carries the orphan image, and significantly and importantly so, if the child is exposed to trauma, that image freezes. It freezes in the mind of the victim, of the person who actually becomes an orphan one way or another. And when that freezes, the person gets not only fixated in a certain stage, but a certain image, a certain psychic image, for instance, the orphan, becomes the dominant in that person's conscious sense of identity. And that is when the person is traumatized.
Yeah, thank you. That's fascinating. I'm wondering, does that archetypal image of the orphan perhaps also contain some healing information? I mean, because the stories that you cited, they also have some kind of resolution often.
Exactly.
So,
most definitely. I thank you for pointing that out. Yes, I don't believe so. When the person has been traumatized, then the healing must come from some sources that help the person to unfreeze that. Mm-hmm. But as a complex, as a teleological, purposeful complex, as a developmental stage, then yes, it is healing to be in touch with it, because we need to carry that sense within us, because we need to experience that sense of abandonment, unless it becomes too extreme.
Yeah, okay.
So I believe it does have a healing function, and it helps our development.
Okay. Now, you've mentioned the divine child and the orphan child. We move on to the puer and puella, which I think of as being, is that considered part of the child archetype, or is that
no.
developed later?
Well, it depends on whom you ask.
Oh.
I personally see that as something later, a further developmental stage. It's later. It's the if we make it correspond with a certain age group, that pertains to adolescence.
Okay, and so for people who are not familiar with those Latin words, like the puer refers to the eternal boy, and the puella the eternal girl.
Let me slightly correct you here.
Fine.
You have the puer eternus. That is the eternal boy.
Right.
And puella eterna is the eternal maiden or young woman. The poor is like, you have the word puerile in English.
Mm-hmm.
It is quite simply the young. As an archetypal image, it, to me, I connect it with the fire. If the child thrives in water, so here we have the fire. We have the fire of youth, which, and you know, in many cultures, rites of initiation during adolescence have to do with fire. Jump through fire rings, or in Israel, for instance, we have the celebrations of what's called Lag BaOmer. That's one of the seasonal festivities. It has to, in practice, it has to do with sitting around the bonfire. And the young will have to learn the idea of fire, which concretely, of course, fire is nature's foremost transformative energy.
Mm.
It can be destructive unless it's reined in and controlled and interacted with by the ego. But if it's in dialogue between nature and ego, then fire can be used as Prometheus does. He brings fire to the use of humanity, to warm, to keep warm, to cook, for transformation. Ideas require transformation. Creativity requires a certain fire. And so I connect youth, the poor and the puella, with fire. The poor eternus and puella eterna, they are stuck and they don't develop.
Mm-hmm.
They long for paradise. They want to be taken care of. They want to remain. They want to remain living in a shadowless existence. Do you know, by the way, at what age Narcissus dies?
No.
Well, he dies at age 16. Because that again, it doesn't have to be 16 concretely, but if we take it as sweet 16 in our imagination, that can be the height of narcissism.
Mm-hmm.
Practically shadowless. We of course have the opposite, the poor young person who suffers from a lack of narcissism, loneliness, what you call it, acne,
yeah.
And feeling clumsy and ugly, etc. But narcissism can only exist, that kind of like pathological narcissism, the height of narcissism, can only exist where there is no shadow. And Narcissus needs to die because shadow enters. We need to know ourselves, which means integrating or confronting the shadow. And that begins somewhere in late adolescence.
Okay, so what is the relationship, if any, between the hero and the puer?
Well, often the hero as a, when we speak about hero, we often think of the hero ideal. And we think of that golden youth, very charismatic, energetic, that may, of course, happen. But You know, we are now in the middle of summer, and one of the months in the middle of summer in the Hebrew calendar is Tammuz. Tammuz was, of course, one of these youthful gods who died long before midlife, died young. It's tragic when the young actually die, whether it's in war or accidents or illness. But as an archetypal idea, youth dies. It dies when we confront the shadow, when we are taken down from those youthful heights that somehow is possible to imagine. The hero ideal is often connected with that, but I see the hero from a Jungian perspective as something quite different. The hero to me is that function in our psyche, that function in the ego of our psyche, that function in our ego consciousness, which turns towards the shadow. That function in our ego that dares to go into the depths, that dares to step into the dark, that function of the ego that goes against, in a way goes against the simple consciousness or the collective consciousness, that function that goes out into the nightscape or the dreamscape at night. So when we speak about dream ego, for instance, when we do recall a dream and we say, I experienced this or that,
right.
that I in the dream is, of course, not my waking ego. It is a nighttime dream ego. And I identify that with the idea of hero, because that's the aspect of the ego that goes out into the unconscious.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking of that was portrayed in Star Wars. You're familiar with the Star Wars movies?
Sure.
Yeah, and so Luke Skywalker going underground to get in a sword fight with Darth Vader.
Right.
Yeah, really captured that.
Yeah.
Earlier, you made reference to Prometheus in connection with the Pu'er. Maybe you can take us through the highlights of that myth and how it applies to what you're saying about the Pu'er.
Well, I think that that youth, the Pu'er, Pu'ela, as images of youth, they are the link between the child and the adult. They try to carry some of the fire, the idea, the ideology, the spirit, and try to bring it into their own adulthood without losing the fire. You will so often hear the young say, I need to be different from my parents. They have submitted to the habits, to regularity. They are only interested in making a living. They have lost the spirit, and I don't want to live my life as gray as they do. Mm-hmm. So I believe that one major task of youth, of the Pu'er and the Pu'ela, is to try to make that fire land safely in the world of adulthood. And Prometheus, whose very name means the one who thinks before, his fire, in some significant ways, pertains to the forethinking. He restrains his impulses. He brings the fire to the use of mankind, to humankind. It should not only be for the gods in the archetypal world. It has to find its place in reality, which is, let's call it, adulthood. And his brother, Epimetheus, which means the one who thinks only afterwards, he rushes into things and basically is burned by the fire. He doesn't get there. Of course, we do need a bit of Epimetheus, because if we always are so well considered and forethinking and do the right thing in our consciousness, etc., I believe that's that can't be done, and I don't believe it should be done either. We need a bit of that impulsivity as well, but it needs to be a bit controlled by Prometheus.
The next major stage that you talk about is that of the adult, which doesn't sound like a very fancy name. It's got no Latin or anything. And is there an adult archetype? I mean, I've never thought of the adult as an archetype. And if so, what are the, you know, characterize that for us?
Well, what I've chosen to put at the center of this, and I think I give quite a few examples as well of clinical examples, but the archetypal image that I've chosen is the king. The king who believes, the king in fairy tales, the king who believes that he can rule as a sole ruler the entire empire, and he can set the laws, and he is the one who decides over the inhabitants in his empire, in his kingdom. The king is often inflated. The king forgets that he is merely human. I think that is what sometimes happens to many of us as adults, and I think it's often what causes some aspects of the midlife crisis. The king, the ego, thinks it can rule by itself, that it doesn't need any connection to its sources. It believes in its individual capability, and some are fortunate to be individually very capable and accomplished, but the king overdoes it. That's why in so many fairy tales, the king must die. And some of those kings are not willing to die. They're not willing to abdicate. They are not willing to turn over the rule to the next generation. They hold on to power. And this is when the spirit is lost, the fire is quenched, it's the extreme of the father archetype, the father who sets the rules, who does not accept that he might be overthrown, like Laios being overthrown or killed by Oedipus. It's holding on to the power and the decision making. I give some extreme examples of this in the book. So I think that that is one aspect of the adult. I give another much more positive image as well, which I like to call the carpenter ego.
Okay. Say a little bit about the carpenter ego. I get the sense of constructing, building.
Right. It's constructing, and you know, to be a carpenter requires patience, to be exact, to replicate something of nature's order, to use material from nature and to relate to it in order to make it fit and to make it stable in the world of ego. And we, of course, have many examples from history, mythology, tales, etc., about the carpenter as father. Jesus' father, the father of Jesus, is one. And another example, if we go to the Hebrew scriptures, is Bezalel, who was the first craftsman. The first craftsman, Bezalel, in fact, means Bezalel in the shadow or in the image of God. So the craftsman is someone in the image of God who is able to, he built the tabernacle, which was supposed to be as if a replica of the universe. And that is what I see as the constructive ego. It has not lost, it's not disconnected, does not disconnect from its sources. It knows that it's merely human.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? We're at about the time length that I generally give to these interviews, and so we'll leave, we'll let the listeners hopefully be motivated to get your book, to find out how the story ends with the Cynex, who would be a good one to talk about, and what happens even after that. And but a question that pops into my mind before we go is, how did you come to be a Jungian? How did that happen?
So let me first, before I answer that, very quickly say about, you say that we leave it to the listeners to find out how the story ends. And Jung so pertinently says that life is the story of the unfolding of the unconscious. And the listeners who are willing to become readers of the book will also find out something that is rarely known, the feminine of Cynex. Cynex, of course, has to do with seniority, senility, the old person. Mm-hmm. But there is a feminine version of Cynex in the classical sources. But I will let the listeners who become readers find out that.
As a teaser.
Right. How I became a Jungian. Well, you know, I was a young person in the 1960s. So I, of course, went from one fad to another and caught up in this ideology and that one. But nothing really had an impact on me. Mm-hmm. But when I did read Memories, Dreams, Reflections as a young person, I felt that that spoke to my psyche. Mm-hmm. I could understand it. There was nothing dry there. This was living. This was alive. This was truly a wonderful story.
Yeah.
And that's how I was caught up.
Yeah, that's great. So, I see that you are going to be part of a webinar on the nature of evil that's sponsored by the Asheville Jung Center, and I have kind of a strategic relationship with them. We try to support each other's work, and I hope to be attending that. I'm going to try to get that into my calendar, so I'll look forward to experiencing that with you. And so as we wind down here, anything else that you want to add?
No, thank you for mentioning that webinar, which Murray Stein, in fact, is doing the webinar with different guests at different times. Mm-hmm. And Murray Stein was instrumental in the conference, the Jung Neumann Correspondence Conference mm-hmm. here. And we are at the moment editing the book, which will be forthcoming from Chiron, called Turbulent Times, Creative Minds, Eric Neumann and C.G. Jung in Relationship. That will probably be forthcoming next year. And I just want to thank you so much for having me here and for your very helpful questions.
Well, thank you. Dr. Erel Shalit, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for hosting me.
What an amazing resource Skype is, allowing Dr. Shalit and me not only to converse but also to see each other. Ordinarily, I turn off the video component, thinking that we'll be using less bandwidth and therefore might be more likely to have a problem-free Skype connection. Dr. Shalit has such a warm and welcoming face, though, that I decided to take a chance today and for us to each use our webcams. I'm glad we did, because I think the visual cues gave us more of a sense of immediacy and connection with each other. Fortunately, the Skype gods were in alignment and we had no difficulties. We take these things for granted, but it's really pretty amazing that we can have these video chats with people on the other side of the world. The world really has become a smaller place in many ways. All of those who have come before us and passed on would have regarded this as a miracle indeed. Dr. Shalit mentioned that he often reflects on the fact that had he been born slightly earlier and in a different place, he would have, in all likelihood, perished in a concentration camp for the mere fact of being Jewish in that time and place. I didn't mention it in the interview, but I share that circumstance. I was probably around 14 years of age when my mother sat me down and told me that my biological father was Jewish. I knew of the Holocaust, and at that young age, I secretly vowed I would never tell anyone about this Jewish connection, not because I was ashamed of it, but because I didn't want to have my unborn children and other descendants to have to risk the dangers of anti-Semitism. What they didn't know, I reasoned, couldn't hurt them. When I was older and in graduate school, I realized that having such a secret would likely exact a price on my psyche, and had the wisdom to come out, as it were. Fortunately, I've never had cause to regret that decision. If you're interested in the topics you heard us discussing, I think you'll want to get yourself a copy of Dr. Shalit's book. So once again, the title of Dr. Erel Shalit's book is The Cycle of Life, Themes and Tales of the Journey. If you would like to order Dr. Shalit's book and at the same time help to support Shrink Wrap Radio, please go to our site and click on the small banner ad for his book that you'll see in the right-hand sidebar. And by the way, his name is spelled Shalit, S-H-A-L-I-T, and his first name, Erel, is E-R-E-L.
Well, hello, Dr. Dave. We would like to thank you for such a wonderful podcast. Although we just started listening a few months ago, we want to contribute financially to all the generous and genuine work you put into each interview. Having been teachers for many years, we know how valuable it is to understand human development. Your podcasts are both particular and comprehensive. By interviewing such accomplished professionals, you help point us toward great books to read and new discussions to have. You have kindled our passion for lifelong learning again. From the Northwest, thank you so very, very much, Jim and Colleen. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim and Colleen Lowry, for your generous support. And thank you also for stepping up with an additional donation during the recent crisis when I had to move all 10 years' worth of Shrink Wrap Radio to a new server or have it all deleted. That felt like a close call, and so your support was especially appreciated. Unfortunately, we've had no new donors since the last show. If you're not already a Shrink Wrap Radio supporter, won't you please step up and click on the multicolored support button in the right-hand sidebar on our site and help carry your share of this community resource. You'll feel so good after you do. By the way, let me call your attention to one of our sponsors. In the right-hand sidebar on our site, you'll see an ad for Unflame, an herbal pain remedy designed by Dr. Robert Hedaya, the founder of Whole Psychiatry, and most recently a guest on Shrink Wrap Radio number 460. Not only is he a psychiatrist, but he's also trained in psychopharmacology. He developed this herbal blend to deal with his own back pain and was amazed to see how effective it was and decided to make it available to all. And I can tell you that I myself am a satisfied user. Well, you can save $5 on every bottle of Unflame Herbal ordered through Amazon, and this offer is for Shrink Wrap Radio listeners only. So use the checkout code of UNFL1815, and you'll see that code when you go to our ad in the right-hand sidebar. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, here's a recommendation to go with my interview with Dr. Shalit today. Unfortunately, I couldn't find the Sophocles play Dr. Shalit mentioned, Oedipus at Colonus, but I did find the better-known Oedipus Rex. We've all heard references to Oedipus Rex, but how many of us have actually heard the Sophocles play performed? Well, here's your chance. There's a nearly two-hour full-cast performance of Oedipus the King on Audible.com. So if you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep, and with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if that one's not to your taste, they have more than 180,000 titles for you to choose from.
Hi, my name is David Bradley. Come on over, have a seat. We'll make room. We're all friends here. All comfortable? All right. You're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, David Bradley. Now let's take a dip into the email bag from our listener community. I have just one today, and it's from Bill, who writes, "Hi, I've really been enjoying your podcast, so thanks for the good work. However, I'm wondering if the audio quality of the host's voice can be improved," the host being me, David. He goes on to say, "It's odd because the recording quality of the guest's voice usually sounds very good, while the host's voice sounds like a low-fidelity compressed stream. It's tinny and garbled, especially in the higher frequencies. One would think that the host's voice would sound very clear and natural since the host is at the source with a good microphone. I access the podcast using BeyondPod, and it could be that whatever stream they tap into is overly compressed bit-wise. Too much compression can create the garbled noises and artifacts that I hear at the higher frequencies on the host's voice. It could just be that the EQ needs to be adjusted on the host's voice, maybe adding some low and mid-range so that the compressed stream sounds better. It sounds like the EQ is just right on the guest voices so that their compressed stream is much more clear. It gets a little tiring to listen to, but the content is great, and so maybe a few EQ tweaks can help. Also, make sure you are recording the master audio for the host's voice at a high bit rate before publishing the compressed version. But I'm sure you're doing that. Thanks, Bill." Well, Bill, I really appreciate your calling this to my attention, and I wanted to read your letter out loud just in case other people out there are experiencing the same thing. So I hope that if anybody is, you'll let me know about it so I'll know how big a problem this either is or is not. I can tell you that in some of the most recent episodes before this one, now this one I think will be a good one, I hope, I accidentally, because I use different applications on my computer, sometimes they will change the port for what mic is being used. So for about three or four interviews prior to this, I was noticing that my voice sounded very echoey. And finally, I realized that Skype somehow, the settings had gotten changed, and it wasn't accessing my podcast mic, but it was accessing the internal microphones on the iMac, and because that's close to the wall and it's further away from my voice, it did not sound all that great, but I think it was quite intelligible. So, Bill, I do think that BeyondPod could be the problem. So check it out on a different podcast player. Go to shrinkwrapradio.com and maybe listen directly from the website there and see if that doesn't sound better. And so I think that will wrap it up for today. You can send your emails, as always, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail using our app, which you can find information about under the Apps tab on our site, or you can use our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Erel Shalit, for his insights into the cycle of life. My next interview will be with Dr. Mark Forman, and we'll be discussing integral therapy, an approach I know nothing about. So I hope you'll come and learn with me. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you, it's all in your mind. Let us all remember, what you seek is what you find. Dr. Dave is here to remind you, it's all in your mind. Exploring our spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you, it's all in your mind.
Been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.